BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon, it's The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sevasodi. The ability to reason clearly and efficiently is perhaps the single most important learning objective common to all subjects and indeed to all aspects of schooling, helping us to understand the children and how they think and reason, getting into their minds, is Peter Mitchell, the Editor-in-Chief of the British Journal of Psychology. Peter, how are you today?
I'm very well and I'm delighted to be on the radio show again.
Yeah, we haven't had you for a long time.
No, that's right. It's quite a while, isn't it?
Quite a long time. Now, Peter, do young children think differently from adults?
They do. And in order to answer this question, we need to think about how adults reason. Mm-hmm. There are two things to say, actually, two facets of adult reasoning. One is the ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, and the other is to be able to think logically. And being able to think in somebody else's shoes is a really, really formidable task. So if we think about humans as having the most powerful brain on the planet, which is definitely true, how did this brain evolve? It evolved over millions of years, and the challenge it faced through this evolutionary story was in coming to terms with dealing with the difficulties of other people, mm-hmm. understanding what other people are thinking, what other people are trying to say to you, understanding how other people might be trying to trick you or deceive you, understanding how to find a partner and the kind of things that you need to do to make yourself attractive to a partner. These are the really big challenges for the human brain. And this is the reason why it's developed and evolved to have the power that it has these days. Mm-hmm. The other part of adult reasoning is to do with being logical, to be able to think in a very clear and logical way about the physical world. Now, it seems that in these two respects that children are quite different from adults.
Right. So we are unable to get into somebody else's shoes as children, and we are unable to think logically.
Yeah.
So how do we, when we are born, what are we equipped with?
We're equipped with a very good brain, for sure, mm-hmm. But probably that brain is one that's able to see the world, to sense the world, to be able to act, to move about in the world in a primitive way, but perhaps not to think in a very logical way or detailed way that connects those two things.
Okay. So when do we start to develop these skills of having to be able to get into somebody else's shoes and to think logically?
Okay, well, perhaps if we can talk about thinking logically first, and perhaps we can talk about some of the kinds of behaviors that we see in children. And what we should do here is acknowledge the greatest thinker on children's reasoning over the past century, and that is somebody called Jean Piaget. Mm-hmm. Now, Piaget was born in Switzerland over 100 years ago, and he came from a family of watchmakers. Being Swiss, you know, he came from a family of watchmakers.
Okay.
Now, we can still see, believe it or not, we can still see the watches that his family makes if we go to KLCC. And if you look around there in KLCC, you'll see a shop. It's called Piaget. Mm-hmm. And you can see these beautiful watches. Well, Piaget was from that family.
Okay.
But instead of following the family business, he set his life's work on trying to understand intelligence and how it develops. And he identified some ways in which children seem to think quite differently. He devised various tasks that or problems that he set to the children. And you can see how children have difficulties with the problems. Let me give you some examples. So one task is what we call transitive inference. Imagine that we build two towers out of Lego bricks.
Okay.
And imagine that these two towers are a slightly different height from each other, but they're in different places in the room, so you can't actually tell by looking which is tallest. Now, if you say to a child aged about 5 years, which of these towers do you think's tallest? And I can guarantee the child will just make a wild guess. They'll just point at one and guess. Mm-hmm. Now, you say to the child, well, let's be a bit more careful about this. How about trying to measure the towers, and you give them a stick that's intermediate length, a stick that's a bit taller than one tower but a bit shorter than the other tower. And you say, how about measuring the towers with that stick to find out? Now, if it's a child age 5, 6, maybe 7 years, they'll have absolutely no idea what to do with this stick. So you say, well, let me help you. You put the stick up against one tower. The child can see the difference in height. You put the stick up against the next tower. The child sees that as well. Then you say, right, so tell me which tower is tallest. And they just make a wild guess.
Yeah. Still don't want to think, right?
So that's one kind of task. Another kind of test is what we call conservation. Now imagine that we have two glasses of water. Mm-hmm. And imagine these are two quite wide glasses of water next to each other. As the child watches, you pour the same amount of water into these two glasses. The child agrees that it's the same amount, and then you pour the content of one glass into a tall, thin cylinder, and the level goes much, much higher. Mm-hmm. And you say to the child, so which has more, this one, or are they just the same? And if it's a child age 5 or 6 years, then they will almost certainly say the tall one has more.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Now, this year I was supervising a project student at my university, and I said to this student, Christine Young, she's called, and she's a really, really great student. She's going to go on to do a PhD right now, actually. And I said to her, for your honours project, I'd like you to do something on conservation. And she said, what's that? So I explained, as I did just now. And she said, no, Malaysian children wouldn't make that mistake. They certainly wouldn't make that mistake at the age of 7 years. And she said, well, you know, maybe 40 years ago when you were a boy, people made mistakes like that. But she said, it's not going to happen now. So I said, well, okay, maybe you're right. Why don't you try it? And then a few days later, she came back. She said, it's amazing. She said, the kids do make this mistake. Even 7 or 8 year olds,
yep,
they still make this mistake.
Yes. What is it? But at the age of 2, if you put an iPad in front of them, they know how to figure that one out. Yeah. How is that?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I actually have a 2-year-old boy. And it is remarkable, you know, some of the abilities that he has. He likes watching, he likes playing with the computer, and he likes watching YouTube and things like this. And actually developing skills to use some of these things. And he can ride a small bike as well. You know, doing these skillful things, he's very good at it. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to reasoning logically, that's something that he's going to struggle with.
Right. So, okay, so that is one area that, you know, they sort of struggle with. Are there other ways in which children think differently?
There are. Well, I was talking to begin with these two areas of intellectual ability. One is being logical, and one is being able to put yourself into somebody else's shoes. Mm-hmm. Now, in this area of functioning, again, we see quite big differences between children and adults. So let me give you some examples. Now, I think this might be an example that's quite familiar to listeners.
Okay.
Imagine that you're talking to your 5-year-old child on the telephone, and the child will often talk to you or maybe even point to things as if you can see it. But of course you can't, because you're on the other side of the telephone. But the child doesn't seem to realize that just because they can see something, and they automatically assume that you can see something as well. They don't seem to realize that their perspective could be different from your perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, again, Piaget investigated this quite systematically in a task that has become known as the Three Mountains task. What he did is he created a model of three mountains, each of which had a distinctive feature at the summit. Like, for example, one had snow, one had a cross, one had a house on the summit. So he put this model on the table in front of the child, and he allowed the child to walk around the table so that the child could see it from different perspectives. And then he had another person sit on the opposite side of the model. And then Piaget said, now can you select a photograph from this set that shows what the model looks like from where your friend Susan is sitting? Mm-hmm. And of course, what the children aged 5, 6 or 7 years did, is they just choose a photo of what they can see.
Of course.
Of course,
right.
Yeah.
That's very interesting, yeah. Peter. I mean, what does it tell you about all of this? And, you know, I also want to know why Piaget, coming from a family of watchmakers, was interested in intelligence. What drove him?
Piaget was obviously a very privileged person. He's obviously a very privileged family and quite a wealthy family. And I think he was probably quite gifted and blessed with quite remarkable intellectual abilities. I don't know why he chose not to go into the family business, but what I do know is that as a teenager, he was interested in shellfish, and he actually wrote scientific articles on shellfish. He was interested generally in biology and evolution. And he felt as though he'd gone as far as he could go with that, and then went into the area of trying to measure human intellectual ability. Mm-hmm. And he worked around about the turn of the 20th century in Paris with the pioneers of intelligence testing, with IQ testing. But then he became quite frustrated with that and dissatisfied with that, and decided that the real challenge facing humanity is to understand how intelligence develops. It's not sufficient just to find individual differences. He wants to know, how does it happen? Where does it come from? How does it develop?
Right. So you would say that children's ability to reason hasn't changed at all?
Children's ability to reason, do you mean over the last 100 years?
Yes.
I think children's ability has changed hugely over the past 100 years. And the reason why I do think this is because what helps you to... reasoning is not something you do in a vacuum or in isolation. Being intelligent, functioning intellectually, you don't do this in a vacuum or in isolation. This is something that you do in a cultural context. Mm-hmm. And I think what Piaget didn't really take this into account, and scholars that followed Piaget started to recognize the value of culture and the particular language that you use, and the value of the tool of language to be able to help you to think and reason more.
Okay, so culture now, does play a role.
Well, culture plays a huge role. Now, I'll say one thing, is that if we use an intelligence test to measure the ability, you know, the average ability of the population, what we find over the past 100 years is that people perform much, much, much better on average on those tests now than they did in previous decades. Mm-hmm. And it's gradually increasing. And one might say, as the culture develops, as the language develops, as more people are educated, then we see this average increase in intelligence.
Fantastic. When we come back, we'll find out more about Peter and some of the work that he's done with his research team on children on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasuri. With me is Peter Mitchell. He's the editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Psychology, and we're trying to find out how children think and reason. Peter, why do adults forget what it's like to think and reason as a child? I mean, we all thought as children, you know, at some stage.
Yeah. It's not just that we forget what it was like being a child. We sort of forget what we were thinking last week, actually.
So, what was my last show?
But it's not just that adults forget what it's like being a child. Children themselves forget what it's like being an even younger child. Mm. So let me give you an example. I was talking earlier about children's performance on a test of conservation. So this is where we have two glasses of water, two wide glasses of water, the same level of water in each, and then we pour the contents of one into a tall, thin glass. And a young child, like a child aged 6 or 7 years, or 5, 6, 7 years, will say the tall, thin glass has more water. Mm-hmm. Now, if we present this same task to a child aged 8 or 9 years, they will say, these two glasses still have the same amount of water. And we ask, why? How do you know that? What makes you say that? And they say things like, well, You just poured from one glass to another. You didn't add anything. You didn't take anything away. If I were to pour this tall glass back into the fat glass, it would come up to the same level it did before. And this tall, thin glass, although it looks as though it has more, that's just because it's tall, but it's also thin, and the thinness compensates for the tallness. They might not quite use that kind of vocabulary, but we can see that's the reasoning that they're engaged in. Now, what Piaget did is say to these children who are giving a correct answer, he would say to them, he'd put a counter-argument. He would say, well, I presented this same task to your friend Little Johnny, and he said that this tall, thin glass has more in it, and he's absolutely sure about it. What do you think of that? Mm-hmm. And they would say, he's completely crazy. They'd say that that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Now, this child who's giving a correct answer, only a year before, they would have given the wrong answer. Now, imagine, so let's just picture this child now, a year earlier, giving the wrong answer of saying the tall, thin glass has more in it. Then we give a counter-argument. We say, well, we tested a child who's in the class above you. He's called Michael, and he said that these two glasses just have the same amount of water. He's an older child, and he said they have the same amount of water. What do you think of that? And they say, he's crazy. There's no way that's the right. It's the tall, thin glass has more water in it. So the children who give these answers, whether they're giving the correct answer or the incorrect answer, are completely baffled by a different answer. They find it completely incomprehensible, even though they themselves would have given an incorrect answer a year earlier. It just doesn't make any sense to them, and they don't seem to be able to remember that that's the way that they used to think.
Right. So 1 or 2 years makes such a huge difference in their way of, you know,
it really does.
You know, find the logic to a lot of things.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you've done a lot of work with children over the past 2 decades.
Mm.
Do children ever surprise or amuse you with their answers that they give you?
They certainly say some funny answers, which don't necessarily have anything to do with the research that we're interested in.
Well, they do say children say the darnest things.
There's one example where I was doing a conservation test. I was asking the child, it's the same amount of drink in these two glasses. And I'd put some colour, some yellow colouring in the water just so they could see it more clearly. And it was a girl aged 5 years, and I said, is there the same amount of drink in these two glasses? And this girl answered with, I don't drink beer, thank you.
This has got to be in the UK.
It was in the UK.
Have you done much work with Malaysian children?
I haven't personally, but I've certainly supervised students who have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising, in one way it's not surprising, how similar children are across the world. As I was saying earlier, the project student I was supervising, she found it unbelievable that Malaysian children, or modern children, would make the kinds of errors that I described. Mm-hmm. She said, well, they certainly won't be making these errors at the age of 7.
Right.
But she actually found that lots of children age 8 years are making those errors. That's nothing to be worried about. It's, you know, it's quite normal, really.
Right. Do you think that, you know, people who come up with the curriculum for science and math, you know, in schools, do they take into account this sort of psychology?
Yes.
They do.
Well, they should do.
So if your child isn't doing very well in school, say at the age of 8 or 9, is it something to be worried about?
Maybe. It depends on the circumstance and the context. But one thing that we should understand, and that teachers do understand or should understand, is that the child will learn best when they're ready to learn. And the fact that the child, a particular child, is taking a bit longer to get to the point of being able to reason logically isn't necessarily something that we should worry about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think that humans actually take a long time to develop, and that's something that really we should be pleased about, there's a lot to learn, there's a lot to understand. And the development of the brain is a complicated process, and it's something that should not necessarily be hurried.
Right.
And I think it does not necessarily follow in any way that children who are progressing through these stages, if we can call them stages, are eventually going to be smarter than children who progress more slowly.
Right.
Might even be the opposite, actually.
This whole creative and critical thinking skills, which everyone seems to be emphasizing on, you know, these days, is it something that can be learned?
Depends on what you mean by creative and critical. By critical skills, I would take to mean the ability to be logical, mm-hmm. the ability to
yes.
analyze. The ability to be creative is to think divergently, to come up with a variety of different answers to the same problem. Now, I'm sure that it's something that we can acquire through development. Now, whether you call that learning, it depends on what you mean by learning, actually. Mm-hmm. If by learning you mean, well, a teacher tells you how to do it,
yes.
then you can do it, I'm sure that's not true. But if you mean that the child is put into a context where they can explore ideas and develop skills, and they're at the right developmental level to be able to take on board this experience, then I'm sure they can learn it.
Right. When you talk about culture, do you think that, you know, children, culture doesn't quite affect your ability to think logically, but it may affect your ability to get into somebody else's shoes and think, you know, that way? Would you agree with me?
The culture
yes.
has that such an effect.
Not so much in the logical thinking.
Mm. In the ability to get into somebody else's shoes. I think it certainly does, actually. We might think of general differences between cultures. Like some people say that Western cultures are individualistic, and some people say that Eastern cultures are more collectivistic. One thing through my own research that I've observed is this is a comparison between how children answer questions in Japan versus how they answer questions in research in the UK. The particular research was about how much children think they know about themselves and how much they think their mother knows about them. So what we see in children in the West, in the UK particularly, is imagine you say to the child, who knows most when you're dreaming or when you're thinking? Or if you say, how much do you know when you're thinking or dreaming? And how much does your mother know when you're thinking and dreaming? And from the age of around about 7 years, children in the UK will say that they're the person who knows more about those processes. And it's as if the children recognize that they have direct access, subjective access, to their own mind. And they seem to appreciate that another person looking at them, even if it's their mother, can only make these guesses or inferences based on an observation of external behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, children in Japan were quite a few years later in starting to judge that they are the authority on knowledge about themselves. And I think that makes sense, really, with Japan, like Malaysia, being more of a collectivist culture. A collectivist culture is where I think there's more a sense of having a shared mind with people around you. You feel as though you have more of a shared mind, especially members of your family.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not so surprising in that kind of culture that children would think that their mind is more open and more accessible
right.
to their mother. Whereas children in the West probably, you know, they're more individualistic. They think, no, they own their own mind and other people can't see it.
Exactly. You have written books and articles and journals on children's thinking and reasoning. Now, what is the benefit of all this knowledge and how can we put it to use? I mean, all this discussion that we've had today.
Mm.
at the end of the day, what can I take back, you know, and how do I apply it?
There are two ways this knowledge, at least two ways this knowledge could be used. One is in terms of applications in education. We're talking earlier about children progressing through stages, and we can see children progress through stages at different times, but if a child is radically different from the normal progression through these kinds of stages, then it might be cause for concern. One particular case in point is the case of a developmental disorder like autism. So one task that we could present to children to find out if they're effective in adopting another person's perspective would be to see if they are aware that another person's belief might be different from the belief that they hold. Now, I'm not talking about philosophical beliefs, I'm not talking about religious beliefs, I'm just talking about simple factual beliefs on what exists in the world. Mm-hmm. So imagine, can I ask this question? Are smarties popular in Malaysia?
Very much.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, in my time.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I should know the answer to this already without having to ask you. But if you take a tube of smarties,
okay,
right, and then you say to a young child, let's say a four-year-old child, you say, what do you think's inside this tube? And of course they say smarties. Mm-hmm. Imagine, though, that when you open the lid, that what's inside is a pencil. And the child can see it. The child says, oh, it's a pencil. And then you put it back in the tube, you close the lid, and then you say to the child, well, I'm going to bring your friend Simon into this room. He's never seen this tube before. What will he say is inside? And if this is a child age, let's say about 4 years, almost certainly he'll say there's a pencil in there.
Yeah.
Well, actually, if you say to that child, I mean, you're not asking about what Simon thinks, you just say to them, now, when you first saw that tube, before we opened the lid, what did you think was inside it? And again, a four-year-old is very likely to say, I thought there was a pencil inside. So again, it's another example that they've sort of forgotten. They've got this sort of amnesia over something that was in their mind only a few seconds earlier. It seems to be overwritten. But when the child is aged a bit older, 4.5 to 5 years, then they say, they give the answers that an adult would give. So they say, when I first saw the tube, I thought there were smarties inside. Silly me, but I thought there were smarties inside. Simon, when he sees it, of course, he's going to think there are smarties inside. Mm-hmm. But what we find in certain developmental disorders, like autism, is that the kids with that disorder can be really, really severely delayed in understanding that other people have different simple factual beliefs than they have. And you can demonstrate that by presenting the simple task that I just described.
Okay.
So, you know, even a teenager with autism who might have, they probably have some delay in their intellectual development, but, you know, let's say it's a teenager with a mental age of, let's say, 8 years, they might still have quite considerable difficulty with that.
Okay, let's just talk about being logical here. You know, some children have a very wild sense of imagination.
Mm.
They do a lot of role playing, and to some extent, it becomes a little worrisome because they are unable to tell whether they're in their imaginary world or whether they're in the real world. Now, this I know has been some cause for concern among many parents. At what age do we start to intervene and, you know, fix this problem? Because they can't tell the difference as to whether they're in the real world or an imaginary world.
Do you know what kind of age of kids we're talking about here?
About 12.
Okay. I mean, you know, if we look at younger kids from the age of about 2 years, we can see the kids engaging in imaginative activities. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I have a son aged 2 years. His name is Hugo, actually. And Hugo has great imagination. He engages in all sorts of role play.
Yeah.
We see this activity quite strongly, especially in the preschool period. And we see it continue. Well, it stays with you for lifetime, actually, doesn't it? You know, you can always imagine things, imagine, yes, a different world, imagine being a different person. But I guess if you see a teenager or somebody who's approaching adolescence who is engaged in so much imagination that it looks so they're a bit confused about what's real and what's imaginary, mm-hmm, that doesn't sound quite right to me, actually. Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily reason for concern. I wouldn't like to alarm anybody. But what I would say is if we think about a disorder like schizophrenia, now, this is something that first shows itself usually in the late teens or early adulthood. What we're seeing there is individuals who seem to have a huge problem distinguishing between what's imagination and what's reality. And that's what the disorder is. That's what the problem is.
Right. Okay. So it could be something, you know, to sort of get it sorted out or, you know, checked out?
I wouldn't necessarily worry about it, but all I'm saying is that in a condition like schizophrenia, this is one of the features of it. Now, just because somebody is in a dream world or imagines a lot doesn't necessarily mean to say that they're suffering with schizophrenia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that would be an schizophrenia is a very extreme case of what I'm talking about.
Okay. Are there any children who struggle to develop adult forms of thinking?
I gave the example of children with autism.
Mm-hmm.
So these are children who would really struggle to imagine the world from somebody else's perspective. And that impacts upon their poor communication, because in order to be good at communication, you need to understand what kind of information it is that the person needs. When you're generating a sentence or an utterance, you need to figure out, well, what kind of information does this person need? Don't give them too much, don't give them too little, give them just the right amount. But to be able to do that, to be able to figure that out, you need to be able to put yourself into this other person's shoes. So we see poor communication. Autism is one case in point. We can see other disorders like attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. This disorder is marked by impulsiveness and perhaps a lack of control of one's own thoughts. This is something that we might call executive function.
Mm.
So executive function is like the brain's ability to control itself, and it seems to be located in the frontal lobe of the brain. And one might regard this as intelligent thought. You know, intelligent. The frontal lobe is the part of the brain that evolved most recently. They're particularly large relative to other areas of the brain, especially in humans. And this is where we see the seat of intelligence, the brain's ability to control the brain. So people with hyperactivity disorder sometimes struggle with some of these controlling their own mind, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in ADHD and autism would be, you know, areas to look at whereby a child is unable to think like an adult.
These are some examples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Your final message, Peter, on how children think and reason.
My final message is, I think this is an absolutely fascinating topic for me, because as Piaget said, one of the greatest challenges of civilization, one of the greatest challenges of humanity, is to try to understand what people are, how they function, how they're able to do it, how are we able to function in the world? How can we put ourselves in somebody else's shoes? How can we reason logically? All of the great technological achievements that we see in the modern world, and the odyssey that you go through in childhood to achieve that is still, to some degree, a mystery. But it's a great challenge for us to try to understand this problem of how we think and reason.
It's something that we take for granted, don't we?
We absolutely do take it for granted.
How many of us actually stop to think about it?
We do take it for granted, and it's not surprising in a way.
Yeah.
You know, we found ourselves on Earth. We don't necessarily know about the details of our ancestral history and how we came to be this way. And so we don't naturally reflect on these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is one of the greatest challenges for humanity at the present time, to try to understand how the mind works.
Well, thank you for, you know, talking to us about it and for getting us thinking about it.
It's my pleasure, and it's great to be back on this show.
Peter Mitchell, Editor-in-Chief of the British Journal of Psychology, on how children think and reason on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.